Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Pope Benedict prays for victims of forest fires which have raged across Italy and Greece. A new charity provides a lifeline for Iraqi Christians fleeing the fighting in their homeland. And Médecins Sans Frontières raises the alarm over dramatic conditions for people in the war-torn Somali capital, Mogadishu. Benedict on Wednesday prayed for the many victims of huge fires which have devastated forests across Greece, Italy and other European nations in recent days, as well as for those who have died in severe flooding across parts of Asia.
Mi riferisco alle inondazioni in alcuni paesi orientali, come pure ai disastrosi incendi in Grecia, in Italia e in altre nazioni europee.
Speaking to pilgrims and visitors gathered for his weekly general audience in St. Peter's Square, the Pope denounced what he called the irresponsible behaviour of those who start the fires, which put so many lives at risk and destroy large areas of our natural environment, the patrimony of the whole human family.
Che mettono a rischio l'incolumità delle persone e distruggono il patrimonio ambientale. Bene prezioso dell'intera umanità.
During his audience this week, Pope Benedict also continued his reflections on some of the great teachers of the early church, focusing this week on the figure of Saint Gregory of Nyssa.
Gregory's outstanding education and intellectual gifts led him first to teaching. He then embraced ascetic life and eventually was ordained Bishop of Nyssa. Like the other Cappadocian fathers, Gregory contributed greatly to the defense of the faith in the period following the Council of Nicaea and played a leading role at the Council of Constantinople, which defines the divinity of the Holy Spirit.
The Pope said for Gregory, the purpose of all learning and culture was the discernment of the supreme human good, the truth that enables us to find authentic and lasting fulfillment. This supreme good, he said, is found in Christianity.
In his many catechetical, spiritual, and exegetical writings, Gregory emphasizes our creation in the image of God, our royal vocation is stewards of the created order, and our responsibility to cultivate our inner beauty, which is a participation in the uncreated beauty of the Creator. By purifying our hearts and progressing in holiness, we are drawn to the vision of God and thus to the satisfaction of the deepest longings of every human heart. I offer a warm welcome to all the English-speaking visitors and pilgrims present to this audience. Upon all of you, I invoke God's abundant blessings of peace and joy.
Pope Benedict speaking at his weekly general audience on Wednesday. The humanitarian crisis in Iraq and its neighbouring countries is worsening by the day as more and more people are fleeing their homes to escape the escalating sectarian violence. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees says there are now an estimated 4.2 million Iraqis displaced either within the country or in neighbouring nations, with a further 60,000 leaving their homes every month. The majority of those Iraqis who manage to flee the country end up in neighbouring Jordan, Syria or Lebanon. Many of them are destitute, struggling to survive without proper jobs or housing, with no education or healthcare for their children. A surprisingly high percentage of these Iraqis are also Christians, who've been targeted disproportionately by the violence that is devastating their homeland. And as my colleague Susie Hodges has been finding out, their plight is largely being overlooked. All Iraqi civilians are falling victim to the vicious sectarian violence and chaos that is tearing apart their homeland. But Christians are often being especially targeted. Church leaders and rights groups say Iraqi Christians are being driven out of their homes systematically by Muslim extremists, and some have described it as ethnic cleansing or even genocide. Before the US-led invasion of Iraq in 2003, there were around 800,000 Christians in Iraq, but now there is estimated to be only half that number. Bombings, kidnappings, threats and attacks, combined with worsening security, have forced thousands of Iraqi Christians to flee their homes. Some districts, such as Doura in the capital Baghdad, were predominantly Christian, but now have been emptied of their Christian residents after Muslim extremists threatened to kill them unless they converted to Islam. The UNHCR says that nearly half of Iraqi asylum seekers reaching Syria since 2003 are Christians, despite the fact that Christians form only 4% of Iraq's population. In the UK, a new charity has been formed to provide help for Iraq's beleaguered Christian minority, both inside and outside the country. The charity Iraqi Christians in Need has been set up by a group of Iraqi exiles who are concerned about the worsening plight of the country's Christians. One of the charity's founders is Suha Rassam, an Iraqi Chaldean Catholic now living in England, who's written a book entitled Christianity in Iraq that traces the history of her country's ancient Christian minority. So does she see the current attacks against Christians in Iraq as akin to an ethnic cleansing or persecution?
To a large extent, it is correct that it is verging into a situation of ethnic cleansing.
And what is the most common form that this ethnic cleansing, this persecution of the Christians takes?
Well, it has started from the very early beginnings of 2003 in the form of threats, kidnappings, extortion. You may say this has affected all Iraqi citizens. That is true, but from the beginning it was more common among the Christians. Recently, however, there has been direct threats asking them to convert to Islam or leave their homes or pay the jizya. And in fact, many people the majority have left their homes. An area in Baghdad, which has been described as the Vatican of Iraq, El Doura, it was home to a large number of Christians. In fact, about 80% of the population of El Doura was Christian. This has been emptied of its population.
Do you think that the plight of the Christians in Iraq has been largely overlooked by the international community?
Certainly they have been. I have been looking very carefully to the large sort of national papers, especially here in England, and there's very little reference to them. And I have tried to make my voice heard into some of the national papers or TV programs. And the answer was that everybody is suffering from Iraq. Well, I agree that everybody is suffering, but there is a special situation for the Christians. First of all, they are not involved in any power struggle. They are not vying for power. They don't have militias to protect them. And they have been kidnapped, extorted of their money. Their livelihood was taken from them. They have been forced to evacuate their homes. Now, they haven't got areas to go to, safe areas to go to. Shiite Muslims are forcing Sunni Muslims from their areas, and the same happens to the Sunni Muslims. And both of them are becoming haven to each other, while for the Christians, they are being driven by both the Shia and Sunni jihadists, and they have nowhere to go to.
The ones that are still inside Iraq, how are they coping?
Very, very difficult, very extremely. Whoever, I have met several who have come here and they are describing the situation as extremely hard, dire situation, really, where something needs to be done. It is hard not only to live daily, it has become even hard to bury the dead. They can't find a priest to accompany them or to take the corpses of their killed loved ones.
Of those that are left, how many do you think would like to leave Iraq if they could?
Well, every one of them would not like to leave Iraq because they feel it is their country, but they feel the situation, if it doesn't improve, I think all of them would like to.
So are many of them losing hope, do you think?
I'm sure there are, because not everybody has the capacity or the material capability of leaving. And when they are leaving, what are they facing? They are in limbo. They are in countries like Syria and Jordan. When they are accepted, even there, they have no jobs. Their children, many of them, have no possibility of going to schools. And they don't know what will happen to them. They have no money to buy houses or to settle anywhere. Even if they go back, their houses have been taken from them.
So how would you describe the morale of these Iraqis who have fled to these neighbouring countries in the Middle East?
I'm in touch with several, especially in Jordan and in Syria. One of them particularly, she lost her husband. She's a mother of two children. One is 9 months old and one is 3 years old. And she is in, you know, I mean, in a deep depression, understandably. Her husband was killed during a car bomb accident. And she has been forced to sort of leave the country, and she really doesn't know what to do.
And what kind of help is she getting? How is she surviving?
She has a sister in Jordan, and she's helping her. And other than this, I don't know. Some friends, most of these people have got friends and relatives in Western countries who are sending these people money. They have become reduced to sort of, I won't call it begging, because their relatives are giving them for wholeheartedly. But it's not a very nice situation to be in, having been a professional in your own country, having had a house and everything, now to be dependent on some relative abroad.
And are they getting help from NGOs?
Not much. This is what compelled us, in fact, to start our charity. Most of them, I mean, the United Nations started to register them, but whoever I asked, they said they haven't done to us anything further.
The desperate plight of many of these displaced Iraqi Christians described by Suha there is amply borne out by the following testimony from an Iraqi Chaldean Catholic man. Tariq, along with his wife and three daughters, is now stranded in Jordan after being forced to flee from their home in Baghdad's Dora neighbourhood earlier this year. He told me how their life as they knew it came to a dramatic end one summer afternoon when they found a letter in their mailbox written by a group of Islamic fundamentalists.
So I opened the letter. And I read that they want me to enjoy their religion or to pay money or to have one of the girls. Otherwise, we will have to kill you with your family. So I take it inside. After half an hour, they ring the bell. But unfortunately, when I open the door, they come, three of them. They put me in a corner, and my wife and my daughters, three daughters, they put in another corner. So they were begging me to have money and to have gold. So I said, I don't have anything. They tried to hit me, to beat me. After that, there is no way. I give them 3,000 US dollars plus some of gold and some Iraqi money. It was 500,000. And then they want more than that. And they told me, you have to give us more or we will take one of your daughter.
Tariq says they were saved at that moment by the arrival of a US military patrol nearby, which prompted their assailants to hurriedly flee from his house.
So they went out immediately. And when he closed the door, he said, don't go out and don't shout. Otherwise, we will kill you and we will come back to you again.
So they didn't take your daughter?
No. I left to other house in the area, they call it Karade. I didn't take anything with me. Only my clothes and my daughter's and my wife's clothes. And my car. I left to Karade because I have a relative there. I stay and I hide there for 20 days.
After several weeks of living in hiding, Tariq decided to leave for Jordan. But as he went on to tell us, his troubles didn't end there. On arriving in Amman, the airport authorities confiscated the passports of his wife and three daughters. And now he is living there illegally, neither able to leave to go to another country and terrified to go back to Iraq.
The Jordanians, they take my family's passport. They give me my passport. So now I have only my own passport. For the family is still in the airport. I cannot do anything. If I go there, they will send me back to Baghdad. And it's very dangerous. And I cannot leave Jordan to go outside Jordan to any place in the world.
And if you go back to Baghdad, you fear you will be killed?
Yes, of course. Definitely.
With so many Iraqis like Tariq driven from their homes following the 2003 invasion, what can and should the international community do to help? Well, to find out more, I spoke to Suha Rasam again.
Do you believe that the Americans and indeed other Western countries like Britain have a moral duty to offer more help to those forced to leave Iraq because of the sectarian violence and mayhem there?
I'm sure they have a moral responsibility, and we have been awaiting an action, whether to help them wherever they are in Syria, Jordan or other countries, or even giving some of them a refugee status.
Do the Iraqi refugees feel in some way rather forgotten and abandoned and disappointed, as you say, with the reluctance of Western countries to open their borders to them or even to offer financial help to those living in other countries?
Certainly they are. We are all disillusioned. We all Iraqis are disillusioned by seeing the Western countries not acting to deal with this dire situation.
Coming back again to the situation of Christians living inside Iraq, how many of them now can still go to church and celebrate Mass, or have most of the churches now shut because of threats, or people are simply too scared to go to Mass? What's the situation like for these Catholics inside Iraq now?
Within Baghdad and Mosul, most of the churches are not giving services, especially after the assassination of the priest Raghid. He was killed together with three of his deacons in front of his church, and that was in May. Another one was assassinated in 2006, and several priests have been kidnapped. And this sort of was the main reason for the decline in church services. This martyr, Raghid Ghanni, he had several threats, which he ignored and continued to say Mass, and in the end he had to be killed.
So, given this situation, how do you and other Iraqis, both inside and outside the country, feel about the future of the Christian community in Iraq? Has it got a future?
We are very worried and alarmed indeed. We do fear the worst, which is the elimination of this rich church or the presence of the Christian community. It has happened in other areas. It has happened in Turkey, if you remember the massacres in the 19th and early 20th century. It has a sort of emptied Turkey of its Christians, and a similar thing is happening now. And if no action is taken urgently, this may well happen.
Susie Hodges speaking there to Suha Rasa of the UK-based charity Iraqi Christians in Need. In Somalia, the International Medical Humanitarian Organization Médecins Sans Frontières has launched an urgent appeal to all warring parties to allow victims of the fighting safe access to medical care. The group says over the past months, access to basic care and emergency assistance for people in and around the capital Mogadishu has decreased alarmingly, with local medical staff deserting the hospitals by the day. Since January, an upsurge in violence in the war-torn city has caused hundreds of thousands to flee their homes for the surrounding regions. And doctors are reporting a dramatic rise in malnutrition among children and the most vulnerable of these victims.
Since years and years, the health facilities have not been able to cope with the needs of this population. We're talking about over than 1 million people living in Mogadishu.
Dr. Christophe Fournier of Médecins Sans Frontières has just returned from Mogadishu. And as he told my colleague Paul Anthem, despite years of experience in conflict countries, he was shocked by what he saw.
At the beginning of January, we were probably able to rely on 800 hospital beds. Now, to date, we are down to 250 beds, which is, you know, it's far from being enough for this size of the population, with increasing needs because of the ongoing fightings. Second, we are following, out of the total hospitals in Mogadishu, we are following six of them. And at the beginning of the year, we were relying on 53 of our colleagues, doctors, still working in these facilities in Mogadishu. To date, we are down to 13 doctors. And why is it? Because the health facilities are not functioning anymore, because they are right in the middle of some insecure area hit by the, you know, the shootings or the bombings, or because the doctors have left the capital with the families. And it's more the population of Mogadishu, the potential patients, the injured people, can barely access these hospitals because of the insecurity, because they are trapped in the neighborhoods where they are, because these hospitals, again, are right in the middle of some areas affected by the insecurity. So that's the situation today, and it seems that none of the parties to the conflict are respecting the work of this medical staff and the need for the patients to be granted this access to health facilities. For us, Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, as a medical and humanitarian organization, we are present in Mogadishu since 1994. But since the month of April this year, we've been trying to increase our activities, to deploy our teams around the capital, to set up hospital facilities, with surgical care, with emergency care. And we have not been able to do that. We are only able to run a few outpatient facilities today, and our teams are totally trapped in the two or three or four areas where we are able to operate. We are not. We are relying on our teams there, but we cannot send international, surgical teams, or any kind of international professional team, because of the level of insecurity that is currently affected the capital.
How is this situation affecting the people who cannot get treatment, and what is the potential impact of people who need medical care? I'm thinking especially of children and obviously victims of conflict.
We're talking about capital, and that's probably over 1 million inhabitants in this capital, although a lot of them have already left Mogadishu. But of course, in a capital, you need everything, from the most basic health care, as you said, for the under 5 children, for the pregnant women, and that's something that we are still able to deliver, but only in some places of Mogadishu. We've been able to do around 60,000 consultations since the beginning of the year. It might sound a lot. It is not at all, I can tell you. Now, you need also to have the hospital facilities for all the most severe ill patients, like in any kind of a big city in this world. And second, as you said, for the injured people, you need to have some sort of emergency care and surgical care reachable by the patients. And that's not the case. We cannot set up that to date. And as I said, the patients cannot reach that easily the facilities. You know, when you hear about the people in Mogadishu today, and that was very shocking for me. When you hear the patients that you will see in our facilities, they're all totally desperate because they don't understand anything of this violence spreading in Mogadishu today. They're not used to that sort of violence. Unfortunately, they're used to a certain level of violence because of the years of war in this country of Somalia. But the nature of violence is changing according to them. It's spreading a little bit all over the capital. And most of them are desperate and trying to leave the capital if possible today.
I was interested, Doctor, that you said, you must have seen a lot of places internationally where there's been conflict and where there's been medical care and there's been problems, but you've able to deliver medical care. I think maybe it gives people an idea about how bad things are, that in your experience, you would still find this shocking despite other things you must have seen.
Yes, as you said, we, MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, as a medical and humanitarian organization, specializing in emergency settings, in conflict settings, we are present almost everywhere in the world where there's a war or some sort of fightings. And we are quite used to, speak with all parties to conflict and manage to get to go through and have access and get some respect of our operations, because that's we're talking about an independent and neutral humanitarian aid that MSF is providing. So in almost all contexts where we are working today in the world, we can go through and get a real commitment and respect from all parties to conflict to allow us to deploy our teams. And it's not that we're targeted in Mogadishu, but still the level of violence and, I mean, the lack of real respect, because you can always find some sort of very nice public declaration from parties to the conflict everywhere. But if it's not followed, you know, very realistically on the ground with the full respect of our teams, then you cannot deploy them. And we are talking about, again, setting hospitals, facilities, emergency care, bringing some sort of international surgical team, relying on an ambulance services, going around in the streets of Mogadishu to pick up the injured people, the most severe cases. That's totally impossible today in Mogadishu. Now, there's another concern also for the humanitarian organization we are. As I said already, hundreds of thousands of people have left the capital and still are leaving the capital. We, MSF, we have several teams right in the outskirts of Mogadishu, a few kilometers away from the city, who are seeing these people arriving on a constant and daily basis. You have, at least in the month of July, 1,000 new people arriving in some locations where we are, so 30,000 over the month of July. And we can see that these people, they're lacking everything, you know, from the most basic needs, such as access to safe and clean water, access to food, to shelter. And we can see in our clinics where we are treating, you know, those displaced persons, we can see among the under five children an alarming rate of acute malnutrition. Over the month of July, and among the under five children who were treated in our clinic in some places just outside of Mogadishu, we've seen a global acute malnutrition around 40%. And among them, these under five children, probably 12% of them were affected with severe acute malnutrition. In other words, with a malnutrition that directly can make them die in a couple of days. So that's a worrying situation. And if we are not able to deploy this humanitarian aid towards the displaced person, then we can fear that their health status will only worsen in the near future.
So what needs to happen to improve things? What would you like to see done?
For me, on behalf of MSF, I'm calling to all the parties to the conflict to really commit and risk to respect this independent and neutral humanitarian aid that we want to deploy. And not only for us, I would say, but I'm calling also the parties to the conflict to respect the work of all the medical staff that is still remaining at work in Mogadishu, and also to grant the population, the patients in Mogadishu, an unlimited access to care.
Dr. Christophe Fournier of Médecins Sans Frontières talking to my colleague Paul Anthem. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can, or find us on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.